now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Yo, technology, what is it all about?
My definition of failure is not trying. And I just wasn't prepared to walk away. Yeah. I knew that this could work, and I just felt like it just has to happen.
Hello and welcome to Danny in the Valley, your weekly dispatch from behind the scenes and inside the minds of the top people in tech. How are y'all doing? I hope that you're all keeping safe and finding pockets of levity and sanity amid these extraordinary and really thoroughly depressing times or troubling times. I am. Our three-year-old just took shipment of an electric car, courtesy of his grandmother. Unsolicited, but you know, no shade, grandma. So trying to teach him how to do a three-point turn in that thing has taken up an astounding amount of my free time. But you know, the thing only goes 1 mile an hour. There's no danger there. But when I'm not doing that, I'm writing and podcasting my life away. And so here we are, another week, another pod for you. And this is one that I've been thinking about for a while. So just to give you a bit of background here, as a journalist, there are a few things I hate more than transcribing. So you do an interview, you get all this juicy stuff, you get back to the office, and then the dread sets in immediately as soon as you hit play on the recorder. Transcribing sucks. And I'm also a bad typist, so it makes it worse. But anyway, it's a time suck, it's a soul suck. And so when I came across this little London company called Trint a few years ago, I was over the moon. So they charged like $40. This is back when I first came across them. It was about $40 a month for 3 or 4 hours of automated transcription. It was amazing. So you just upload the file, and a few minutes later, there it is, this searchable audio and Word file. It was amazing. But what happened after that was even more interesting. After Trint, a bunch of other transcription companies started cropping up all over the place. And they were slashing prices. The one I use now, Otter, offers 6,000 minutes for $10 a month, which is, it's effectively free or pretty close to it. And if you need just a few hours, there are others where you can actually just get it for free. So I wanted to connect with Trint's founder. He's a former journalist. His name is Jeff Kaufman. And I wanted to talk to him about what that is like. So you create this super cool new thing, and then you are immediately swamped just by the speed of technological improvement. And it just leads to this question. How do you adjust when the core thing you offer, the whole purpose of your startup, is suddenly available for free by a bunch of other people in a bunch of other places? So that is what we talk about. So it is an interview about Trint and Jeff's story, which is super interesting. But it's also an interview that I imagine a lot of entrepreneurs will identify with. You know, what happens when the problem you solve is no longer a problem? So anyhow, that is what you're about to hear right now, which is my conversation with Jeff Kaufman, founder of Trint. And we spoke over Zoom, obviously, because that's all you ever do these days, from his home in London. Enjoy. Thanks for taking the time. Appreciate it.
Hey, greetings from the other side of the Atlantic in London.
I first came across Trint probably almost 3 years ago, because transcription for journalists is one of the worst parts of the job. At least for me, if you had an hour interview, it would take 3 hours to transcribe. And it was like, stop, reverse, rewind, play it again, play it slow, try to get the words right, etc. It's just a nightmare.
I feel your pain. I've lived it. I mean, you know, listen, for a journalist, transcription, manual transcription is a bit like waiting for an elevator or waiting for an airplane. It's just time and life lost.
Exactly.
And that's candidly what inspired me to do this.
It's magic. You just upload your file and you wait a few minutes and all of a sudden, like, boom, you have a new, you have a transcription. And it's not perfect, you know, but it's pretty close.
I mean, it's funny you say magic, because first of all, two thoughts on that. Somebody once said to me, gee, transcription is inherently the most boring topic you could think of, and you guys somehow make it exciting, which I thought was, as a backhanded compliment, a pretty good one. But the word magic, it's interesting you say it. We just relaunched our brand with a new logo and a new website at Trint.com, but also a new tagline. And we've moved beyond being a simple transcription service to a productivity tool sort of in the spoken word, sort of the content production workflow. And our new tagline is actually speech to text, to magic, because I think that magic does things that you didn't think were possible. It's so interesting because it was one of the things about my job as a broadcast journalist in Canada and the US and overseas as a foreign correspondent with ABC and CBS News. All of that glamour, you don't feel any of it when you're sitting in a hotel room or in, you know, or in a, you know, some forward operating base in Iraq with your computer on your lap and you're trying to listen to an interview and transcribe it because you need to have the precise words so you can write your story for Good Morning America or World News. That was the drill I lived literally for 30 years of my life. And seeing it automated and being able to say, hey, where did she talk about fear?
Yeah.
Bang.
And you know, can just search it, fear, and it's there, and it's like, oh my God, I don't have to listen to this tape for 15 minutes to try to figure out what it was.
And because the machine generated text is glued to the source audio or video, you search the word fear, you go, oh yeah, here's the reference. You play it, and even if there's an error, you can quickly fix it. So that whole thing about scrubbing through audio to find the moment, how to not make friends as a broadcast journalist. Give somebody a very long interview and say, hey, can you find that moment when she talks about fear? Oh, where is it in the interview? I think it's around somewhere in the middle. And, you know, sort of if looks could kill, you know, young interns or seasoned producers would say, you don't have a time code. It is this kind of bottleneck of inefficiency that comes out of, I kind of historically trace it back to the 1960s, the release of the first cassette recorders, which became pretty ubiquitous by the 70s and 80s. And, you know, when I was a young reporter, I used to have a mini cassette, the reel-to-reel mini cassette that could fit in the palm of your hand. And I used to hold it just out of camera when I was a local reporter in Toronto in my earliest days. Then, you know, you'd rewind it, you'd get in the news van or whatever it was and rewind to the top, and then you'd listen to it, you know, as you're driving back to the station to edit your story, which in those days was 3/4-inch videotape, don't even ask. And, you know, and you'd scribble down on your notepad in my chicken scratch writing what the quotes were and hope that you could find them. And if the person was really long-winded, or God help me, if I was too curious and asked too many questions, it's pain.
It's so interesting about this kind of particular pocket of technology, let's call it, is that your experience 30 years and before you were doing it, decades more of people trying to just struggling through these mountains of audio, trying to find that stuff, transcribe, etc. There used to be transcription services, I know. You have this bottleneck of inefficiency. When did you guys start? What year?
So I left ABC News as London correspondent November 30th, 2014, and started building Trint December 1st, 2014, with a team of three developers. We launched commercially to consumers, what we call prosumers, because they're professional consumers. It's not a consumer product. September of 16, and then Trint Enterprise was launched just over 2 years ago, spring of 2018 at NAB.
Right. So call it 4 years.
Almost. Yeah. 3.5 years in the market. Yeah.
So, and in that time, so I came across you guys, I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then later, and this is where I have to hold up my hand here, I came across a company called Otter.
Sure.
Who
I've heard of them.
Who so I think what you guys were offering was $30 or $40 a month for 4 hours, I think was what it was initially, the plan that I was on. And then Otter, someone pointed me to them, like, they do 6,000 hours for $9. And so what I'm interested in is just trying to understand, so you're in the midst of you're in the eye of this technological kind of revolution in transcription. And it goes from this impossible task to very quickly getting near free. And how do you build a business in that transition?
Because from a distance, it looks like we're arch rivals and competitors. Yeah. What they do is great. And, you know, if what you need is what they, you know, what they can help you with, more power to you and to them. Our market is not simply automated transcription made searchable. That's where we began. That was our initial product in 2016. But, you know, we now have a collaborative tool. So you're sitting, where are you? You're in Silicon Valley,
yeah,
right?
I'm in Oakland.
Okay, so you're in Oakland. I'm sitting in London, England. You know, say this was an interview and, you know, or we, somebody else has done one. You and I can collaborate on Trint like Google Docs and listen to it. And you can say, where did she say fear? I'm sure she said it. And we can talk both, you know, on the document through comments, as you would in the behavior of Google Docs. Mm. We can highlight, we can export, we can share, et cetera. We have enterprise grade data security, military grade data security. We're certified by the International Standards Organization with ISO 27001, which for a small startup, you must have run across this in the Valley. Yep. It's a nightmare. Yep. It is a huge, huge lift, incredibly expensive. But, you know, the clients we're going for are people who care about these things. They want to collaborate. They want to know their data is secure. You know, we have incredibly proactive customer success. We do training. We do enablement. We have 24/7 customer support. What distinguishes us is we just have this fabulous user experience journey. Just because they can do what we can do doesn't mean the products are the same.
Yeah.
We just got a note that came from a user saying, tried them, tried you. You guys make me weep. You're so beautiful to use. It's so easy. So yeah, you know, competition is healthy. There will be more than one player in any market. Somebody once said to me, if you don't have a competitor after a couple of years, you got to ask whether you actually have a viable business. Because we're differentiating by offering an evolving and more elaborate product for producing content and, you know, finding it, whether it's for journalists, whether it's for marketing content, for the big logos in the Valley. Yeah. Most of the big logos around you are using Trint. You can tell that this excites me. And what's really, for me, kind of shocking is that I loved being a journalist. I mean, I ticked all of the check marks in my bucket list of journalism as a foreign correspondent for ABC, covered Latin America for 10 years, the Iraq War, the Arab Spring, you know, won a couple of Emmys, did all of that stuff. I mean, I couldn't imagine. And frankly, I was, if I'm honest, slightly nervous about what a second career would look like after such an amazing first career. But wow, I mean, this is so interesting to be innovating and inventing and imagining, talking to users, saying, what, you know, well, what would you want this to do? And if you could, you know, invent Trint in 2 or 3 years, what would it look like? And it is as creative as anything I've done. And when you build an incredibly strong creative team and you can actually start to execute, you really feel like you're making a difference.
So can we go back to the founding? So one of the things I want to kind of try to unpick or understand is what happened? How did this go from this impossible, terrible task to something that can be done in an automated way?
I have no idea. I mean, it was totally unplanned, Danny. I mean, you know, people have master plans. I stumbled into this. You know those little cartoons where the light bulb goes off over the head? That's what happened. I was teaching a summer program for 21st century journalism, and a friend said, hey, if you're teaching 21st century journalism, you should come to MozFest this weekend and see the cutting edge of innovation in media. MozFest is this open source conference sponsored by Mozilla in London every fall. And people from around the world come, and it's really developers, software developers. I don't actually know that I'd ever been around a group of software developers before I walked in that building. But this friend, who was actually with the Knight Foundation out of Miami. Yeah. You know, I was ABC's correspondent in Miami for 10 years, so I know a lot of people at the Knight Foundation. He was working in London for a while, and he introduced me to some people and sort of said, here's some interesting stuff. And I found it totally intimidating. You know, you see code on a whiteboard, you kind of go, really?
Yeah.
I mean, what am I doing here? I have no understanding what this, you know, how this is done. It's like, you know, Greek or magic tricks or something. And he introduced me to these guys who had done this experiment with speech aligned to text, not with transcription, not with video, but just kind of karaoke style.
Right.
And I just said, oh, that's cool. I've never really thought about it, but why do I have to transcribe in the 21st century the way they did in the 20th century when, you know, isn't like automated speech good enough?
Yeah.
And they hadn't done anything in that area, but I just kind of asked a curious question. And one of the developers, this really smart Romanian guy, said, "Well, what do you mean? What would the solution have to look like?" And I didn't really know the answer. And we talked for a bit, and they went their way and I went mine, and none of them lived in London, and we kind of communicated by Skype. And I was really interested in trying to answer his question: what would the solution have to look like? So after some discussions, we tried a speech-to-text algorithm, and we tried to do this word alignment, but then it had to be editable, which it wasn't. And anyway, after a lot of back and forth, using some of my interviews as test tapes, we came up with a solution. And I just said, holy cow, we've just invented the future. Mm. We have to do something with this, because it didn't work at that point, but it showed promise. And I said, I have no idea how to do any of this, but I know that the world needs this solution. Either we get together and try to make this happen, or we just say so long, never see each other again, and you're going to walk into a Starbucks in a couple of years and somebody's going to have built this.
Yeah.
So essentially, you know, the way I see it in retrospect, I was out on a flat ocean on a surfboard just as the wave was starting to form.
Right.
And I just happened to see that wave because I fit this kind of classic profile of a late stage entrepreneur. I have lived the problem that I'm solving.
Yes.
And so I have a deep understanding. If it has to work for me, if it's going to work for you as a journalist and millions of others. And the hypothesis was, if it worked for me, it probably was going to work for a lot of others. And I don't know, I just got this fire and I just said, holy cow, this is a really interesting opportunity. We have to do this. And I think they thought I was nuts. Mm. I mean, and in retrospect, I was. You know, you live in the Valley. All of these companies start with a vision and a passion to move it forward, to see if you can do it. That's what drove it. And an understanding, in retrospect, I put it this way. I grew up in the 20th century in really what was the text economy.
Yeah.
As a little boy, I read newspapers on print. When I traveled, I wrote postcards. My parents and grandparents would have sent telexes and telegrams. You got your news from radio and TV, but it was quite a passive experience.
Yeah.
You know, you spoke on the telephone, but you didn't record in those days. But maybe as an early reporter, I did, but on that reel-to-reel cassette. But it was a text-driven economy. Along come the 1980s, and you know, Bill Gates and others developed, you know, word processing, which became Microsoft Word and all those other things, to make the spoken word or text word searchable, discoverable, shareable, malleable, all of those things. So you can go through your computer and you can search a phrase, or you can go through the New York Times website and find it. We now live not in the text economy, but in the voice economy. And we live on the voice internet. And we need tools to navigate the voice internet, to find content, to optimize value, to share ideas in a way that make it as dexterous, as nimble as text is. And that's really where the market opportunity is. And that's why, since you and I first talked 3 years ago, there's been so much progress, because, you know, that is the reality.
Yeah.
Most of the traffic on the internet is now audio and video. And look at the growth. You and I talked in 2017 first time. Look where podcasting has come since then.
Yeah.
I mean, you even have one.
Exactly. Exactly. Case in point. In terms of the technology, is everybody working with the same technology? Was there like a Google API that is underlying this explosion of suddenly all these companies?
So that's a really interesting question. So the history of speech to text goes back to, I think, the 60s and 70s when supercomputers first, 1960s and 70s, when supercomputers first started to come along. It was in the beginning of the 21st century when storage capacity increased exponentially and the speed of computing increased exponentially, basically so you could put a lot of information on the head of a pin or much smaller, that the ability for speech to text to start to actually be useful really became transformative. And it really, I don't know precisely when, but it's not much more than 10 years that speech to text has been within the range of usable accuracy for more than sort of general trends.
Yeah.
I mean, it was initially used in call centers for finding words or you know, keywords or trends and stuff, but as a kind of consumer or professional tool. What's happened since then is that there are probably, I don't know, 10, 20 algorithms out there, but really only about six major ones. It's kind of a solved science now, speech to text.
Yeah.
You know, the AI part of it, the meaningful differentiation between the top six players, Amazon, Google, and the others, is mostly inconsequential.
Yeah.
IBM, for reasons I don't understand, Watson is far behind. I've never quite understood why.
But they each have a publicly available API or algorithm.
Yeah, you can
upon
use
which
it
you can build.
To a limited degree. There's some of them offer free for a limit, but you know, if you want to use it commercially, you pay for that, and then or you can develop your own. I mean, you can create your own data science team or work with teams, external teams, and develop or license, which is what a lot of the companies have done too. To a certain degree, the focus on the AI, and this is, I think, a theme throughout where you live in the Valley, is a slightly misplaced focus. It's not simply the AI. AI in itself is not a value. It's what you do with it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, where Trint takes it much, much further than the other companies in the ecosystem is we take AI and then we add a layer upon layer of what I call applied AI, meaning the productivity tool, the software experience, the user, the UX and the UI, the user experience, user interface that allows people to do things and that solves the actual workflow problem that you and I have lived with. And wow, I knew none of these terms when I began 5 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, I kind of laugh and I think, oh my gosh.
If only you knew how little you knew.
I did know how little I knew. I think one of the things about being a journalist, being a journalist actually turns out is actually pretty good training for being an entrepreneur because one, you know how to hustle. Two, you know how to deal with the reality you're facing and just make it work. You know how to ask for help when you're in trouble because when you're, you know, when you work for ABC and you go on air and you didn't fact check, you don't last long. So you got to be able to say, hey, I'm not sure about this. Can somebody confirm this? And you have to be able to say, hey, I don't understand this. Can we get somebody to explain, help us understand this? So I think that kind of humility comes with those high profile jobs or with any journalist job. And it turns out it's a pretty good, they're pretty good ingredients for people who are first time entrepreneurs because, you know, you don't have to know what you don't know, but you have to know how to find answers and ask questions. And one of my sort of ongoing jokes of self-deprecation is that I feel like this has been a 5-year project in writing Startups for Dummies. and you know, this is my, every time I think I'm nearing the end of a chapter, another chapter appears and it's like, wow, we're now a scaling company. I mean, the company a few months ago was 48. We just hired 2 more people yesterday. We're 65. We have 11 openings. We'll be close to 80 soon. I mean, we're under coronavirus. We've actually seen incredible growth because we enable remote working. Because,
I was going to say, presume that, I mean, you're one of those few companies who's actually, I mean, it's all horrendous, but benefiting from this massive shift to video calls and everything, everybody working remotely.
Well, yeah. And if you're on your own and, you know, you work normally in a collaborative form, one, we allow you to work together even if you're apart. And two, if you don't have anybody helping you, we can do the heavy lifting for you so you can focus on, I like to put it this way. We use AI to liberate you from the menial so you can focus on the meaningful. We actually enable people to do their jobs. You know, sometimes people tease me about, you know, oh, you know, what's it like taking people's jobs away? But that's not really relevant to our kind of AI and our kind of product. Because in fact, what we do is in a world of diminishing resources, more and more platforms for content, we allow you to focus on producing content, not spending, like you just said, 3 hours to transcribe a 1-hour interview so you can start writing. Well, guess what? You know, with Trint, you put it through and you can sit down and start writing in, you know, in minutes and say, where did she talk about fear? Oh, here's the moment.
For me, it's so interesting because it's the one thing, especially working at a print publication, and obviously we're moving much more to digital again, largely accelerated dramatically by coronavirus, but it is the biggest change in my work life since I've been doing journalism. And especially with podcasting, it is a total game changer.
So let me go back to the 1990s. I was a national reporter at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in Toronto and an anchor. And this thing called .com, as we called it then, comes along. Or I think actually one of the anchors, the first time they put it up on the screen at CBC National News, the big network newscast, said CBC point CA or something, which was the website, or CBC period CA. Because, I mean, the whole concept was so new. And it was like, wow. When .com came along in the newsroom, and we, you know, you're a national reporter, you file for the national, they said, oh, you know, .com, CBC.ca.com wants you to do a story. It was like, I'm busy.
Exactly.
And it was
totally.
It was really the bastard stepchild of the newsroom.
Fully.
Any reporter who was in a newsroom in the 90s would know that nobody's looking at
and
it.
In the,
it
and
terrible.
to be truthful, in the aughts as well. I mean, you always want to be in the newspaper. I was at the Independent, and then, you know, for the past 11 years at the Times, and it's and for some people, and a lot of people in the newsroom, that is still the case. You want to be in the newspaper first.
Right, exactly. And there was like, what do you mean? It's just going on online. It's not going to go, you know, on the newscast. It's not going to go in tomorrow's paper. And that was considered, oh, like that's a bronze medal.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want bronze medals. Yeah. And then there was this shift, I think, sometime after, you know, 2003, 2005, where actually you got to pay attention to this. And actually you're paid to do this. And I think what happened, I was at ABC News at that point. I moved from CBC to CBS in New York where in 97. And even then, CBSNews.com was still pretty much the orphan and struggled to get us. You know, it was really kind of a competition to see how long you could avoid writing for CBSNews.com. By the time I moved to ABC in 2001, it was starting to get better. The design, it was more malleable or more friendly. And then I think the big change was when newsrooms started to move the so-called dot-com or online teams out of a separate room into the main newsroom. Mm. And you have these kind of sort of multi-functional hubs. If you've ever been to the BBC headquarters here, you know, there's a massive room. Yep. Normally, without coronavirus, it would hold hundreds of people. And there's a whole huge, huge section next to the video section of the social media, the online people. And they're just as important in today's world. In certain ways, maybe more important. When that happened about 15 years ago, that's when the transformation really happened in terms of the prioritization and how we started to outlook to do stuff. But what that meant, and the reason this comes back to Trint, is that a single piece of content that just went on the newscast tonight or in the paper tomorrow, and therefore had a fairly, in most cases, if not luxurious, manageable deadline, suddenly you had, you know, Facebook and Twitter were coming along.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, you got to get it on social media. And by the way, you know,
speed
we need
or the
to put
it all
video.
Sped up.
So a single piece of content could go to, in a major news organization, could go to 6, 10, 20 different platforms. You look at CNN or the BBC or, you know, NBC, which has CNBC, which has MSNBC, you know, which has the Weather Channel. A single piece of content might have to go to 15, 20 different platforms within the news organization at the same time. And, you know, we had a senior executive from CNN came to do one of our, what we call lunch and learns with the team earlier this year before lockdown came. And she said, you know, we now don't allow content to go on a single platform before it can be accessed by every platform. Mm. Otherwise, we can put it on one CNN arm, NBC picks it up and they're broadcasting it on TV before CNN even, you know, video knows. So that's why you need to be able to find content, collaborate on it quickly and get it out there. And so that's where the acceleration of demand for a product like Trint has come.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host Luke Jones for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So I have two questions. One, when we're talking about the underlying technology and, you know, how Amazon has an algorithm, Google has an algorithm, et cetera. Is there any reason to create your own? And what are you guys doing?
I think less and less. So you know, we're a bit coy about this because ours is a blend and we talk about a secret sauce. And so we don't go into the details of what we use and how we use it. But candidly, if you gave me $10 million, it's not where I would put the money in investment because there's so many other, you know, that's, as I say, a solve science, a commoditized, low cost product. And it's less and less important in terms of innovation. I think that the opportunities for innovation in data science and productivity in this space that have yet to be solved are massive. And some of them are pretty complex and expensive.
So this is what the other thing I wanted to get to is, so you start out 4 years ago, whatever it is, you come out with this product like, oh my God, this is automated. This is amazing. And then everybody else starts coming. Was at any point that kind of terrifying of like, I come out with this thing that is magic and then all of a sudden everybody's doing the same magic trick and it's getting cheaper and cheaper to...
Do you want to know the truth?
Yeah.
Yes, it was. The first time somebody copied us, you know, we're toast.
Yeah.
Because I mean, I'm, you know, I have no business experience.
Yeah.
And I have to say, one of my board members who was an early investor, he actually, you know, I mean, I didn't publicly panic, but I had a slight heart palpitation. And I said, see, we have our first competitor and they've actually just copied our website. I mean, literally, he said, that's a validation. Don't rush. And they were much cheaper, but they weren't very good. Their UX was and remains. It sucks. I mean, you can have them for what they charge because they're not very good. I'm not going to mention. I don't want to trash by name. You know, I think what you realize is that, as I said earlier, competition is healthy. I just say to my team, I'm happy to have competitors. I just, you know, in a couple of years, want to make sure that we're Google, not Bing.
So that's what's so interesting is that like you come up with the magic trick, everybody starts performing the same magic trick, and then you're like, oh God, I can't be satisfied. Now I have to go do all this other stuff to differentiate. I mean, did you envision that at the beginning, or were you like, all right, we're just going to create this thing and it's going to work and it's going to be great, and then presto change-o, we're a big success.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I didn't have a master plan.
Yeah.
I mean, when I call myself the accidental entrepreneur, I'm being honest. If you had told me 10 years ago that this was even going to happen in my life, I would have bet you a large sum of money with odds very favorable to you that there was no way I was going to leave the best job in the world, you know, as a foreign correspondent for ABC News to do this. I mean, there was just no way I would have. 10 years ago, I was just rocking it, having the most interesting, challenging stories. In fact, in 2010, I was the lead correspondent in the Gulf oil spill, spent 4 months living in the Mississippi Delta, then went straight down to Chile to be the first foreign reporter to cover the Chile mine rescue and spent most of the 7 weeks of that rescue in the Atacama Desert on what was in 30 years probably the most fascinating story of my life and the most logistically difficult.
What was the moment where you're like...
Well, the moment was that light bulb moment when I worked with those developers, you know, worked talking to them on Skype in 2014, I guess it was, when we kind of just poodled around, you know, remotely and said, what would it have to do? To answer your question about when did I realize it had to be more than a transcription service that could be copied, there was a natural evolution because I recognized that I wanted to do more for me. And what was very interesting, you know, you flattered us and said that you felt it was like magic. A lot of people who use the product do. And what's really cool about software that solves a problem is that people feel a sense of investment and excitement about it. And so they're very, very open about telling you what they wish it would do. And so what you start to see is this huge amount of validation coming from users saying, this would be great, but can you do translation? And it's like, well, why would you use it? What do you want? And, you know, as you develop a product team, you start to ask those questions. And so, you know, Google runs this, has run this program in Europe called the Digital News Innovation Fund. Mm-hmm. I think it's now called the Google News Initiative. And we won two grants from Google, initially 50,000 euros very early on to build one of our early products, and then a 300,000 euro grant to build our translation tool. And we released it sometime in early 2019. And it, you know, you can take this conversation, print it, put it in any of 50 something languages instantly. Or you could be doing this interview in Portuguese, which I don't speak, print it and translate it into English. It's not going to be 100%, but you're going to understand, you know, where is the moment where, you know, the Prime Minister of Portugal is talking about fisheries and whatever, you know, you want, or tourism and coronavirus. I think they have a president, not a prime minister. Anyway, there you go. But the point being that these come organically from the users and from, and also from our own blue skying. We actually have a very clear roadmap that can takes us a couple of years in. I mean, it doesn't mean that we know what we'll be doing in December of 23, but we know what on that list, and that's always being challenged and changed and prioritized. As I've learned as a first-time entrepreneur, you always have to ask yourself, what is the business case for adding this to the product? Will it make the product more valuable, more stickable? Will it make more useful? Will people pay extra for it? What is it going to take to actually build this? I mean, is it, if it's just a week and it's just cool, then maybe we can do it. But if this is going to be, take an engineering team and product team of 8 people, 6 months to do, we better darn well know what we think we're going to get out of it. And so, you know, that's where we're at. And so you talk about, yes, people can go to other products, but yes, you can buy a cheap car for what, you know, 20,000 US, and you can buy a used car for 5,000, but lots of people buy Teslas. Much better cars and BMWs and Audis. Why? Because it's a better experience. It does more things for you. It's safer in their case. We're more secure. And it's just a more intelligent vehicle. That's the nature of business, you know, meaningful differentiation of products and product offerings. So we're unapologetic. We are an innovation-led company, product-led company, solving problems for users. And you know, one of the things about Trint, it taught me this concept. Trint solves a problem that I didn't even know I had. Somebody in California a few years ago had this idea of seeing if there was a way to wash lettuce and package it in a way that it wouldn't go bad. And by putting this inert gas into the plastic, into the bag, the lettuce would last a week or 10 days without turning brown. I mean, there's an example of solving a problem I didn't know I had. I mean, you know, when we were kids, our moms washed lettuce because you had to, and we learned to wash lettuce when we went to university or whatever, and we, you know, and that's just what you did. It wasn't a problem. It's just what you did if you wanted to have a salad. And then this guy solved a problem we didn't even know we had. Well, Trint solves a problem we didn't even know we had. Transcription was just part of it, and there are lots of parts of the productivity workflow beyond transcription that we now, you know, with translation, collaboration, and some of the stuff that's in our innovation teams right now to be released this year and in the future that solve problems that people didn't even know they had because they didn't think it was possible.
How much money have you raised? Because you say you're up to 80 people, almost on your way to 80 people. That's substantial.
So we, in UK pounds, I think it's about 7.8 million pounds. So that's in dollars, about 10 million.
Yeah.
Our revenue is really strong now. And so we're not, you know, we continue to hire. You know, we're debating whether we might want to raise some more money, but it's not because we need to. It's because we might, you know, just to accelerate growth. But it is pretty amazing. But we're in a very strong position financially in a time when I want to do anything but gloat about it, because friends of mine are, you know, seeing their companies struggle and collapse. And, you know, I take zero joy, you know, in seeing that happen around. But this space of workflow productivity was ripe for exploration and development. You know, I actually just wrote a piece about this, that, you know, this coronavirus lockdown, the fact that it happened just now is really, really interesting, because the alignment of the software opportunities happens to have put us in a position where we can actually, for a lot of professional jobs, can be sustained and remote in a way that 10 years ago would not have been possible.
Yeah.
And a lot of the life we do, forget work, but I mean, you're talking about Netflix and taking virtual yoga. You're talking about ordering from Amazon.
Yeah.
All of that 10 years ago wouldn't have been happening.
No.
I mean, as debilitating as lockdown is for all of us today, imagine what it would have been like 10 years ago, or go back, you know, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, you would have seen complete economic collapse. The extension of that is that all of these software tools like Slack, like Zoom, like Trint are enabling people to do things that would not have been physically possible a few years ago. So it's a really interesting alignment of this historical catastrophe and the rise of software that does so many things that, and enables them.
What was your worst day of work?
That's an interesting question. There were some, let me put this diplomatically.
Okay.
There were some pretty stormy moments in the early days of this company. They won't be surprising to a lot of founders in Silicon Valley, but people's visions clash and it can get pretty ugly.
Mm.
And there were moments like that. There were a couple that were pretty difficult and pretty existential about whether it was worth it. It was one of the hardest tests to sort of make it through all of that and conflict of vision and execution. And there were moments when I thought the emotional toll of this is just too difficult. It's
yeah.
just not worth it. And, you know, my kind of, I guess the neon sign on my imaginary wall across from my desk says, my definition of failure is not trying. And I just wasn't prepared to walk away.
Yeah.
I knew that this could work and I just felt like it just has to happen. And so getting through that period, candidly, was really, really difficult and one of the hardest tests of my life. But I did, we did. It also made it really important for me to create a positive culture in the company because I think one of the great joys and one of the biggest surprises, I knew that if we could build this tool, it would be amazingly satisfying. I've never managed people, you know, as a reporter,
yeah, yeah.
as a correspondent, network correspondent. I never had direct reports. I never had an annual review. I never had a 360. I was on performance contract. And so what I really resolved was that I wanted to build a place where people really enjoyed working and that had a positive culture. And building a team that shares those values, that's excited, that's collaborative, that's authentic, that doesn't, you know, I actually said to somebody who was in a job interview, you know, this is a company where there are the three B's are banned, no bitching, no backstabbing, no bullshit. And she looked at me, she said, where do I sign up? Because,
right.
you know, I mean, you know, being a network correspondent too was really tough. I mean, you know, it's a highly competitive, high stakes, high money job. And, you know, when you're competing for airtime, competing against other networks for stories and other news organizations, it's not always the nicest place.
No, no.
I just kind of have this view at this stage in my life. The destination really matters, but I think we should find a way to enjoy the journey, which doesn't mean it's a leisurely walk by any means, but I don't believe that yelling at people or being a nasty boss is the way to motivate people. And it really, really infuses the culture with this passionate, enthusiastic, collaborative sense of authenticity. And you talk about the worst, that's the best. I think, and the hardest part about lockdown for me is that I love working with this team and, you know, I see everybody virtually and it's like, let's go for a walk. Let's have a coffee.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, thank you for being so generous with your time and I wish you luck.
Thanks. Stay tuned.
Yeah, I will.
And,
I will.
Watch this space, but hey, thanks and stay healthy.
Yeah, likewise. And that is all the time we have. I want to thank Jeff for taking the time to speak. I want to thank you for listening. And for, of course, just sending in all of those fabulous reviews and ratings for this podcast. Keeps my boss very happy. I will be writing about tons of stuff this weekend. I don't want to spoil it, but there's some good stuff in the paper. So do check that out. Subscribe to the Sunday Times, please. Anyhow, thank you for listening. You can also find me on Twitter at Danny Fortson. You can email me with any questions or any suggestions at danny.fortson@sunday-times.co.uk. That is all I have. Keep well. Talk soon. Bye-bye.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.